This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. The bank robbery capital of the world is Los Angeles, but bank robberies are on the rise in small towns across the country. The FBI reports that last year, nearly a third of U.S. bank robberies occurred in small towns. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about the crime and the people who commit the crime with William Rader. During his career with the FBI, he responded to the scene of more than 2,000 bank robberies. Bill Rader and journalist Gordon Dillo are the authors of Where the Money Is, True Tales from the Bank Robbery Capital of the World. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Give us a call. Here are the numbers. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest, Bill Rader. He is acknowledged as the most experienced bank robbery investigator in the U.S. He served in the Federal Bureau of Investigation for 33 years. He's currently a managing partner in a security management and litigation consulting firm. And he was FBI technical advisor for the Steven Spielberg film Catch Me If You Can. His book, Where the Money is published by W.W. Norton. Again, the phone numbers, 333-9455. That's the number for the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Bill Rader, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, it's great to be here, Celeste. Good afternoon to you.
Who was it, when asked why he robbed banks, said, because that's where the money is?
Well, that was Willie Sutton. Willie said that in the early 1950s, after he had been captured after a series of robberies, and they asked Willie, why do you rob banks? And his response was, that's where the money is.
Duh. Now, why is L.A. the bank robbery capital of the world?
Well, because since 1979, we've had more robberies here on a per-year basis than any other FBI division anywhere in the country. And it's as simple as that. The numbers tell the story.
And it's also easy to get in the car and zoom off.
Well, it is. If you're asking for specific reasons, there are three as to why we are the bank robbery capital of the world. And the first is the fact that since the Gold Rush days in the 19th century, California has always favored very, very liberal banking laws, which allow for unlimited branch banking. Currently, there are over 3,800 different branches of national banks, savings and loans, and credit unions here in the Southern California area. And that means there's a bank almost on every corner. And, of course, each one of those is a bank robbery target. Second is a tremendous population that we have, a population that's been growing since the 1960s by leaps and bounds. And today in our area, there are over 17 million folks. And, of course, we have all the attendant social and criminal problems of any large urban population, namely large numbers of hardcore narcotics addicts, and emerging and very dangerous street gang problem. And both of these groups tend to figure heavily in bank robberies in our area. And third, of course, you already pointed out, we have a freeway system that allows these folks to move very rapidly and easily throughout the entire seven counties that are covered by our Los Angeles division of the FBI. So with all three of those factors at work, that's why we are, very simply, the bank robbery capital of the world.
Yeah. There's a chapter in your book about gangs and bank robberies, L.A. gangs taking the crime on the road to places like Des Moines and Indianapolis. This began in the 90s, thanks to a couple of characters by the names of Casper and Sea Dog.
That's correct.
You want to tell us about them and their legacy?
Well, actually, very interesting guys. Casper, true name Robert Shelton Brown, was involved with a street gang called the Rollin' 60s Crips. And the Rollin' 60s Crips are one of the most vicious and most violent street gangs of the many street gang sets that we have in Southern California. And by, as I say, age 14, he was already a full-fledged member of the gang because he grew up in a community here in Los Angeles called Hyde Park. And Hyde Park is one of these financially deprived areas where, unfortunately, not many options for youngsters growing up there. Once they're in school, there's a lot of pressure to join a street gang just for survival. And Brown joined one and made very quick progress up the gang ladder to the point where he was considered by age 21 to be an OG or original gangster. And he had garnered a lot of attention because of the criminal acts that he had been involved with, and he was quite influential in the gang. His partner, Sea Dog, whose true name is Donzel Thompson, had been friends for many years. In fact, since junior high school, they were friends. And they formed what turned out to be a criminal enterprise in which they used younger street gang members to actually perform bank robberies where neither he nor Sea Dog would go into the bank, but they would convince others to do the crimes for them and to turn over the bulk of the money to them. So they became somewhat of the godfathers of bank robberies here in Southern California.
Yeah, and this was remarkable to think about, that these guys could do more, they could make more money, they could steal more money than they could by being in the drug business.
Well, in fact, that was the genius of Robert Shelton Brown, was that he figured this out at an early age. He had done enough crime by the time he was 21 years old. He'd done, according to people who had interviewed him and that we had talked to, I mean, he had done a number of different crimes. He'd engaged in sales of narcotics. He'd been involved in burglaries. He'd done street robberies. He'd done commercial robberies. And when he was inside, because he was frequently picked up and put through the California Youth Authority and had gone through county jail, but he obviously picked up some information that stuck with him about doing bank robberies. Probably he picked this up from some older guys, but his genius was that he was able to figure a way to do the crime without putting himself or his partner Sea Dog in actually doing the robbery by going inside and subjecting themselves to being identified by eyewitnesses or leaving physical evidence such as fingerprints or having their photo taken with surveillance cameras. So he figured out quite rapidly that this was the way to go, and that the money was much, much better in doing bank robberies than it was in doing any of these other crimes.
Yeah. Does this phenomenon of lost boys, lost children, gang kids committing bank robberies continue?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, statistics here in the Los Angeles area, despite the numbers of robberies, which have dropped dramatically since 1992, we still have approximately 600 bank robberies a year. Our record in 92 is 2,641. But the problem is not so much in the numbers of robberies as in the nature of the robberies, because even today, almost 40% of all the robberies that we encounter here in the Los Angeles division are so-called takeover robberies, where you have multiple bandits who go in and take control of the premises in a very violent way. So consequently, this gang-related problem of takeover robberies is still very much in effect in Southern California and has somewhat marched across the country in a little bit of a more limited way, but it's still present. And these are L.A. street gangsters who are fostering this problem as it does move across country.
It really ramps up the danger, doesn't it?
Oh, there's no question about it. In fact, all of the violence factors, which I kept very close track on in my last 18 years as the bank robbery coordinator here, that is the coordinator of all bank robbery investigations, those violence factors, which are shots being fired during the course of a robbery, customers or employees who have been shot, who have been assaulted, or who have been robbed personally during the course of a robbery, have all occurred during the type of robbery that I call the takeover robbery.
Yeah, real different from the caper robbery.
Much different. These takeover robberies out here, particularly, and now as they move across the country, tend to involve very young street gangsters, who enter the bank in something of an explosion of loose fitting clothing, sweatshirts and pants and whatnot, a showing of firearms and jumping counters, a lot of profanity. Certainly a lot of psychological problems afterward for the customers and their employees. We're talking about post-traumatic syndrome at ultra-high levels.
Yeah. Bill Rader is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about bank robbery, the crime, and the people who commit it. Bill, together with Gordon Dillo, is the author of Where the Money Is, True Tales from the Bank Robbery Capital of the World. Bill, we have a listener online this afternoon joining us from California. That'll be our first caller this afternoon on the toll-free line, Line 4. Go ahead.
Yeah, how are you? I'm kind of interested in this because when I saw his title, a specialist on security issues and whatnot, my mind instantly flashed to the fear industry, and how much money is being raised keeping people afraid and having to protect themselves at all costs and damn the cost, just sign this blank check. So I'm just wondering, listening to his little last exposition there, describing some subculture, when everybody knows that this nation is being robbed from up in the penthouses, not at street level. It's easy to pay a street gang with crack cocaine that you're bringing in through the CIA. It's easy to do that, and then you fill up the prisons with them and make the prisons private so you can make slave labor out of them and cash in on the tax dollars that are mandated to paying for the prisons. So, it's just one more of those fear industries, and I was just disappointed when I heard Will, talking. I heard 10 years ago, it was said that the average Chicago cop pulls out his gun, not even fires it, pulls out his gun, in the need of duty, every 27 years, the average cop. So it 27 years, well, this guy seems to be alleging that there's this danger on the streets every 14 seconds. And that, why pay ultra-high dollars for something we know we're not being bothered by?
Okay. Bill Rader, you want to respond?
Well, all I can say is that I have statistics that indicate that we do have these types of robberies, that violence is a problem, I don't know what else I can say. It sounds like our friend on the phone is something of a fan of the conspiracy theory and so on, but this is a problem. I mean, violence is a problem in our nation. I'm not trying to throw a scare in anybody. All I'm trying to say is that you have to be aware of the facts in these situations, and certainly the statistics and the facts back up what I'm saying. I'm not trying to create a climate of fear here by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, I had indicated that the numbers of robberies had gone down dramatically in our Southern California area because we were paying attention to these violence factors and whatnot. And in fact, we've actually created a partnership with law enforcement and the banking community to put down these violence factors and whatnot. So I don't know what else I can say regarding that. I'm certainly not trying to create a climate of fear in any way, stretch or form.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. One other thing I want to point out before we go to our next caller is that one of the things that strikes me about the characters in Where the Money Is, the variety of folks who rob banks and the ways in which they do it. In addition to gangsters, others are businessmen or lawyers or doctors or school teachers or cops gone bad. So there's all kinds of folks out there in the bank robbing business.
Well, actually, there are. However, I must point out that those who were involved in doing bank robberies, who were not doing it necessarily as a profession, but those who have engaged on it in a very limited way, and we're talking about the doctors and the lawyers, and there were one or two policemen, you know, who had engaged in this. All of these folks were facing a somewhat desperate situation, usually a situation created by a financial desperation, and they turned to bank robbery as a quick fix, as an answer to their problem. And, of course, this is a tremendous mistake to do this, because in 75% to 85% of the cases over the years, these robberies are solved, and the crime nets the person who commits the crime very long stretches in federal or in local institutions.
Let's talk with another listener. We're going to go to a caller on line one in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Interesting conversation. There is a community about 25 miles from where I live. It's about 50 miles from Urbana-Champaign, called Bloomington Normal, that has had, I think, some of the highest bank robbery rates in over the last 2 or 3 years. It's a fairly wealthy community. But the question arises out of a continuing argument I've had with a friend who simply states that if the bank tellers were armed, the robberies would be taken care of, because there would be an immediate reaction, and this would deter the people that are involved. I think I know what I would think. Could you give me your answer to that particular solution?
Yeah, certainly. In fact, armed tellers had been tried up in the San Francisco area a number of years ago, actually in the 70s. They were hiring policemen who were working as a second job as a bank teller, and of course they were allowed to carry their weapons during the course of their employment at the bank. And in fact, it had resulted in several shootings of bank bandits. Unfortunately, there were also some customers and other employees who had been injured. I think the whole thing was a disaster. Mm-hmm. I don't think that arming employees is any way to approach this. In fact, I'm not even a tremendous fan of the armed security guard. I think interjecting another gun into a volatile situation is the wrong way to operate.
That's about what I've told him, because I think the banks would fear the loss of life, an innocent loss of life, and I mean, no one knows what's going to happen when that situation arises.
Absolutely. Interjecting a weapon into a situation like this, which is volatile anyway, is a tremendous mistake.
Yeah.
Banks should not be in the business of corralling bank bandits. That's the responsibility of law enforcement.
Could I ask one more question, please?
Sure.
Have you ever come up with a demographic of bank robbery, or as Celeste says, is it just so varied it's hard to come up with something? I mean, other than you did start out with a gang in Los Angeles, but I mean, in a national demographic?
I don't understand the question.
I mean, is there more or less, besides gang members, certain groups that would be more likely to rob a bank or not by occupation?
Oh, I understand completely. Not so much by occupation. But please understand that bank robbery is almost always a crime of desperation. And who in our society are the most desperate? And the answer is drug addicts.
I see.
And so consequently, we're dealing in almost 85% of the cases with drug addicts. And I'm talking about hardcore drug addicts, folks who are going to get sick unless they feed their habit. And what happens in that situation is that need overcomes fear every time.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's go and talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Hi. You haven't told us, how many bank robberies were there in the state of California last year?
In the state of California?
Yes.
In the state of California, of course, we have four separate FBI divisions, okay, and they are Los Angeles, San Francisco, Sacramento, and San Diego. And the numbers are as follows. In Los Angeles, we had 645. San Francisco was second in the nation with 362. And then we had Sacramento with 217 and San Diego with 168. So we're looking in general numbers here at probably around 1,400 robberies.
A fair number.
For the state of California.
How many fatalities were involved?
We had last year probably three or four fatalities during that time. I don't have the exact statistics for the other divisions. Most of those statistics involve bandits who were killed during the course of their activity.
Hmm.
The others involve security guards. There have been years in the past when we've had as many as a dozen deaths in the state of California. Most of those involve security guards and bandits. But we also did have in 1997, of course, that was a very violent year. That was the year of the North Hollywood shootout. And we did have a death of a customer and a bank employee, a victim teller. And then, of course, the two bandits who died, and then the rest were security guards.
And a majority of these, of the bank robbers, you say, are drug addicts.
Yes, absolutely. But in the takeover realm, and you have to understand that there are two very basic kinds of robberies. The one is the one-on-one situation, which involves one bandit and one victim teller. There may or may not be a gun that's shown. The bandit wants to confine his robbery transaction to just that one person, the victim teller. And in many cases, it's just the victim teller who's a witness to that robbery. That's a very different animal from the takeover, where you would usually have multiple bandits who demand attention when they come inside, because they take control of the premises during the time that they're inside. They want everyone to know that they're in control and so on, and that's where all the violence is.
And those are gang members.
In many cases out here, and probably 90% of the cases in California, and certainly in Los Angeles, these are street gangsters.
Well, thank you.
You bet.
Thanks for the call. Next, we go to a listener on the toll-free line, Line 4 in Belgium, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Your guest here in the last discussion here has mentioned drug addiction as a serious problem in this several times. Don't you think maybe if we changed our arcane drug laws, we might solve a little bit of this problem?
Well, I think that there's a possibility that if we could in some way cut down the numbers of addicts, we would cut down the numbers of robberies. But as far as how we approach this, both politically and socially, that's something that's beyond the scope of my expertise.
Yes, sir, I understand that. That the unfortunate thing is that our country has taken a point of view in drugs that's just accelerated the problem farther and farther. Thank you very much for your time, sir.
You bet.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, other comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Bill Rader is our guest this afternoon. He's the author of Where the Money Is, True Tales from the Bank Robbery Capital of the World. Of all the criminals you encountered during your career, would Eddie Dodson be the most unforgettable?
I think that Eddie, who is probably, well, he is, the most prolific bank robber that has ever come across our radar scopes at the FBI. Eddie had robbed 64 banks in a spree in 1983-1984, was then sentenced to 10 years after we finally had caught up with him. And then after he had been out for about 4 or 5 years, he reverted to drug problems, drug addiction, and committed another 8. So he had a total of 72 robberies during the course of his entire bank robbery career. And Eddie was probably one of the most likable individuals that I had ever met on the other side of an interrogation table. In other words, in the criminal world, Eddie was a charmer, and I had spent many hours of conversation with him when I had retired, and Eddie was in a federal correctional institution in Victorville, California, and we had even decided that when Eddie got out of prison, that we would somewhat go on the road together at various security gatherings of banking people and law enforcement people. And I could present the bank robbery story from the investigator's point of view, and Eddie could present the story from the bandit's point of view. And I thought that that would go over very well. Unfortunately, Eddie, in his last spree of robberies, had taken up using the needle to inject his drugs, and had developed hepatitis C. And very shortly after he was released from prison, he died. And I felt very badly about that because Eddie and I had become fairly close. And in fact, Eddie had gone so far as to tell his personal representative that he wanted me to give a eulogy at his funeral, which I did. So I had entitled the chapter about him, Everybody Likes Eddie, and that was the case, and I was one of the people who was able to get beyond the criminal aspect and talk to him as an individual.
Yeah. Well, everybody liked him. He was a charming guy, and once upon a time he lived a charmed life.
He did indeed. In fact, it was one that he had brought himself very close to the Hollywood entertainment community. He was a dealer in antiques and so on, and he had met most of the wealthy and powerful members, certainly the acting community, and had formed some very close associations with him. In fact, one of his very close friends was John Belushi, and he and Belushi had met up to the time of Belushi's death, and they had done drugs together and so on. And in fact, when he got out of prison, Jack Nicholson took him in and gave him a job as caretaker of his Malibu properties. So everybody, including the entertainment community, liked Eddie.
Yeah. You empathized with several of the robbers you pursued and caught up with. In general, is that true of the agents who investigate bank robberies, and does that help in the successful pursuit of bank robbers?
I don't necessarily think that that's the case. I was always interested in the personal aspects of what drove people to do these crimes. But while I was while I was investigating the crime, I certainly wasn't necessarily thinking about what kind of personality I was dealing with. It was only after they were caught that I took something of an interest in in what kind of people they really were, and what and what kind of brought them to do this kind of a crime.
Hmm. You have a law degree, and I wonder, have you ever wondered if you could have been a defense attorney?
I don't know that I would have been that empathetic to be a defense attorney. In fact, my bent was always one that would have lent itself to prosecution, because I'm very much into assembling facts and presenting them in a rather orderly way.
Yeah.
And for me, that probably would have been the best avenue to pursue, and that's certainly where my interests were.
Yeah. Well, for our listeners, I want to tell our listeners a little bit more about our guest, Bill Rader. He has a degree in commerce and finance from St. Louis University and a law degree from St. Louis University School of Law. And he describes his childhood in St. Louis, where he grew up, as something out of Ozzie and Harriet. So now, Bill, this is the question. What was it that attracted you to the FBI?
Well, very, very early on, when I went to a Jesuit high school, a St. Louis U High, in fact, in St. Louis, one of the first things we were given to do as a freshman in a speech class was to give a talk based upon what you thought was the most interesting job in the world. And I somehow hit on FBI agents. So I had done some reviews, and I had read a lot of books that had been written by people who had been in the Bureau or with the Bureau at the time. In fact, most of the books about the Bureau were all done with Bureau sanction at that point in time. And but anyway, I became somewhat enthralled with the whole idea of FBI agent, even as a freshman in high school. And I somewhat continued that interest, even though I kind of put it on the back burner by the time I went to college and law school, and then I rekindled it again, when we had the special agent in charge of the St. Louis office come out and address a group of us who were graduating from the law school as he was recruiting for the Bureau at the time. And I thought, well, this would be a wonderful way to, you know, kind of get out of the Midwest and see the rest of the world and so on. They were only asking for a three-year commitment at the time. And so I threw in with the Bureau thinking, well, I'll be with them 3 or 4 or 5 years, see how it goes, and maybe then I'll go back and practice law in St. Louis. And as many of the fellows that I graduated with had done, very few had left town, and I just was one who wanted to see the rest of the world, so to speak.
Well, your first assignment, though, was Cleveland.
Yeah, it was. That was falling out of the,
falling out of the dream there.
Yeah, exactly, you know, and into the fire, so to speak. But it was a wonderful year that I had in Cleveland, not so much because of the weather, because that wasn't, you know, first priority, but they had wonderful work. And I was working almost 7 days a week at the time. Most of it involved the violent crime world, and I just fell in love with bank robberies from the very first one that I went to. And I was as hooked on them as any addict was on his drug, and I just couldn't get enough of it. And that's why when I was ultimately then transferred after a year to Los Angeles, that I gravitated toward the bank robbery squad in Los Angeles. And once there, I saw that this was absolutely the work for me, and I stuck with it the rest of my career.
Yeah. Now, when you signed on, Hoover was still at the helm.
Indeed.
And you say his hypocrisy was legendary. Did that turn you off?
Yeah, very much. I was not sure that this was the right organization, you know, for me. This was very much a one-man proposition. I mean, he ruled the Bureau with an iron fist, and I didn't know that that this was how I wanted to spend the rest of my years. But as I said, I fell in love with the work, and I got beyond that. And then, of course, Mr. Hoover passed away in 1972.
Yeah. Tell us about getting through the Hoover Welcome Aboard test.
Well, that was a very interesting time. I remember as a young 25-year-old, you know, brand new agent, still in the training school phase of my Bureau existence, meeting you know, the leader, the director, the god, if you will, at the time, and it was a very nervous time for most of the others in the class because it was built up that way. I mean, he was one who at a whim could end your career, even on this first meeting. And when we filed through and met him, because I was so young and really had nothing to lose, I had a law degree anyway, and I figured, well, if he didn't like the way I looked or the way I acted, I could always go back to St. Louis and, you know, kind of rekindle a legal career. So I went through and saw, you know, Mr. Hoover, you know, standing there on a little something of a little platform where he would look down on those who would come through to meet him. And that's how we did it in those days. Today, of course, it's much different. When you graduate from training, now you have your family come out and so on. It's very much like a high school or a university graduation. Well, in those days with Mr. Hoover, it was very closed. There were no friends or family invited. It was just you filing through with your class. You met Mr. Hoover. You were directed to shake hands, tell him who you were and what city you were from, and that you were happy to be aboard as an agent. And he would nod and say, "Welcome to the FBI," and that would be it. You went out the door, and that was your first and probably your last meeting with the director.
Hmm. Back to bank robberies. It's really a tough crime to get away with. There are cameras, there are marked bills, there are silent alarms. And on top of this, because bank robbery gets in your blood, if you're a bandit, apparently you get addicted to it.
You definitely become addicted to it. And that's because you are sure to score some money. And for the time that you're inside the bank, which is usually less than 2 minutes, your life is somewhat on the line. You don't know who's going to be responding in terms of law enforcement. And these folks, you know, have told me numerous times in interviews that this is almost addictive as the drug they may be taking at the time. In other words, that adrenaline rush is such that every fiber of their body is alive during the course of them putting their life on the line to do this robbery situation.
And eventually that can lead to their detection and arrest.
Well, in almost all instances it does. As I said, almost 85%, 80 to 85% on a yearly basis here in Los Angeles, these cases are solved. And consequently, these are not good odds, you know, to be bucking, and yet they do because there's a desperation that leads them to do it, and then they become addicted to it. So consequently, 95% of all of the robberies that go down in the Los Angeles and across the country, for that matter, these robberies are done by serial criminals. I mean, you don't rob just one bank. I've often likened it to eating potato chips. You don't have just one. You stay in this for the long haul. In fact, you stay in it until you get caught. And that's the bottom line.
But now tell us about the story. Tell us about the gang that tunneled into bank vaults.
Well, this was a fascinating group. This was a bank burglary as opposed to a robbery. They had taken advantage of the storm sewer system that runs beneath the entire city area of Los Angeles and carries off the rainwaters, you know, that occurred during the peak rain months here between November and April. They had found a way, this group of bank burglars had found a way through the storm system to get within about 150 feet of a bank vault. And what they did was they used the storm sewer system to cut a hole inside the pipe, and then they tunneled a well over 100 feet from the storm sewer into and underneath the bank vault. And then they broke up through the vault on a weekend and took all the cash from the vault and then, of course, broke into the safe deposit boxes. The total loss in this entire situation was about $2.5 million. They got $172,000 in bank cash, and the rest was taken from the safe deposit boxes. And then the bank made good on claims for about $2.5 million. They then made their getaway through the storm sewer system, and they were never seen again until a year later, when they used the same system about 3 or 4 miles south of the bank that they had burglarized in Hollywood, and did the same type of a burglary where they went and tunneled through the storm system. They got up under a Bank of America and got into the vault and took some cash, but the Bank of America at the time did not use time locks on the door. So when the alarm went in, when they had set off an alarm by going into the vault, Bank of America security people showed up and opened up the vault, and these guys had to skedaddle fairly quickly and took about $92,000 in cash. And they had also set up a tunnel to do a second job the next day, but we found that tunnel and they were unable to do it. And to this day, we don't know who it was that burglarized those three banks.
Mm. So bank burglary then perhaps not as addictive as bank robbery?
No, not so. And it took, these are jobs that are more in the caper line of work. In other words, these are jobs that take great amount of planning. It takes a great amount of execution. In fact, in the tunnel jobs, we figured that on each occasion, it probably took them at least a month or longer to actually dig these tunnels. And these tunnels were rather intricate in that, they used electric lighting on the inside that was powered by a generator. gas-powered generator on the outside. There were several anterooms, chambers that they had dug, underneath to store tools and whatnot as they got in. So this was quite a lengthy planning and actually doing of the job, and took a lot of intricate work in order to pull it off. But even at that, when you consider how many people were involved, and we figure at least five or six folks were involved in all of this, and by the time they split up all the money and so on, it probably wouldn't have netted them, quite that much on a yearly basis. I mean, they weren't able to go retire and live in wealth for the rest of their lives by any stretch.
Yeah.
So, but actually, in putting that story into the book, I had something of an ulterior motive, because since these were the guys who had gotten away over the years, mm-hmm. I'm hoping that now that the statute of limitations has run, that the book might even generate a phone call from one of these guys, because I would certainly love to talk to them about how they did this and what their game plan and so on was, and why they never did another one.
Yeah. No word yet, though.
No word yet. But hope springs eternal.
Yeah. So who do you suppose these folks were? Do you suppose they were in the, as you speculate, that perhaps they were in the construction business, or they had to know their way around heavy equipment and that kind of thing?
A full reading of the chapter would tell you that my thoughts on the thing were this. These were terrific guys in terms of the type of tunnel they could do, which sort of lend itself to, folks who were in the construction industry or miners or whatever. But once they got up and into the bank, their knowledge about actually performing a bank burglary was quite limited, because they did not know exactly how to get into these safe deposit boxes. They did a botched job on the safe deposit boxes, and in fact, a lot of them were rendered so that they couldn't even, make an entry, even with the tools they had. They just wound up banging on the boxes, using crowbars and whatnot, and trying to drill them out in a very complicated process. There's another means in doing it, and of course I'm not going to explain what that is, but there's another means to attack these things that's much more effective. And they didn't use it. So I think we had some great construction guys, we had some great tunnel guys, we had some very poor bank burglars once they got inside.
Yeah. In that chapter, you say, and as you hinted at here just a moment ago, that you'd like to hear from these guys, and you'd like to buy them a beer. You don't take this personally, that they got away, and that you're sorry you didn't nail them.
Well, as a law enforcement officer, certainly you're sorry you didn't come up with it. But as far as taking it personally, there's no law enforcement officer that should take this stuff that personally. In other words, you don't lose any sleep over this stuff. You do the best job you can. You are professional. Sure, you're drawn in to a certain extent because your ego is involved. But at the same time, there are many other things that are going to demand your attention, and life is broader than one crime or several criminals.
Mm. Well, there we have to leave it. We've used up the time. Bill Rader, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, it was my great pleasure, Celeste.
Bill Rader and Gordon Dillo are the authors of Where the Money Is, True Tales from the Bank Robbery Capital of the World. The book is published by W.W. Norton.